Welcome, everyone. I'm going to wait for folks to be able to come in from the waiting room, so I'll give this a few minutes just to get started. I was excited to see that over 350 people signed up for this webinar, so I'm sure it's a topic that's of great interest to many of you. And I look forward to starting shortly. So for those of you that are just joining, I'm waiting for a few more minutes for the everyone to be entering in from the waiting room. I can see people still coming in and the numbers increasing. So when that pauses, I'll start. Okay, I think we are ready to get started. Welcome everyone. I appreciate you all joining me today. I am super excited to be able to talk with you about ways that you can use this opportunity of this crisis to increase your philanthropic impact. And I'm excited to share strategies that you can use not only now, but in future times when things are quote unquote back to normal. I wanted to introduce myself first. I am Chris Putnam Walkerly, president of Putnam Consulting Group. I've been advising philanthropists of all kinds and sizes for the past over 20 years, ranging from ultra high net worth donors to family foundations, corporate giving programs, community foundations, private foundations, family offices, people with donor advised funds, as well as working with wealth advisors and estate planning attorneys to help them to help their clients. I work with a wide range of funders, many of whom I'm sure you'll recognize, the Annie Casey Foundation, David and Lucille Packard Foundation, Smuckers, down to small foundations that you have never heard of all around the country and increasingly around the world. So I'm excited to be able to share with you today. I also would like to thank the two organizations that are co-sponsoring this webinar with me. I think one of the things that this crisis has shown us is that there's a lot of opportunity for us to learn from each other, and there's a tremendous value in being part of members of philanthropy-serving organizations because there's a lot to learn. So one of those is Exponent Philanthropy, which is a fabulous organization, actually the largest member organization of funders in the United States. They specifically work with what are called lean organizations, lean funders, those with few or no staff, as well as individual philanthropists and families and individual donors. They have a fabulous live discussion happening right now every Friday during this crisis, and I encourage you to check that out and also look at their website, exponentphilanthropy.org. The next one is the National Center for Family Philanthropy, which, as its name suggests, is all about family philanthropy. Again, working with donors, small family foundations, and some of the largest and most generous families and family foundations in the country. They also provide tremendous resources, individualized guidance and help. They have a great knowledge center that you can search through on their website, ncfp.org. And also, they've been mapping out the crisis response funds that are popping up all over the country. So if you're looking for a fund to support, definitely check out their website. And seriously, if you think as an organization or a person, you could benefit from either of these two organizations, I really encourage you to check them out. So here's what I'd like to accomplish today. My goal is really to help you as a philanthropist, either working in an organization or as an individual or family, to realize that there is tremendous opportunity right now to use this time as a catalyst for change, and that you can transform how you give and sustain that change well past this crisis, past the recovery, and into the future. It's really about being resilient, I think, and it's about not just bouncing back from adversity, but bouncing forward and bouncing ahead for greater impact and greater effectiveness. I think what's been most amazing about this crisis from a philanthropy perspective really is how many foundations, corporate giving programs have been implementing new best practices, right? So they've been unrestricting grants, offering core operating support, removing deadlines, giving grants without requiring any kind of application. And one of the things that they've been doing is like dropping the tightly held beliefs and protocols and systems and processes that they've held on to for decades, right? So things like we don't provide core operating support grants, or we must require a site visit for every grant that we give out, or we only make decisions when the board meets in person and that happens twice a year, or four people have to sign and approve a grant before it can get mailed out, physically mailed out, right? And so these restrictions have been dropping like hot potatoes across the country and across the world, right? I mean, funders have been dropping, they couldn't drop them fast enough. And I think it's really remarkable. And I think that my goal really is to ensure that these best practices are sustained into the future. And really my fear is that sometime in the future, like I don't know when, maybe, I don't know, in the middle of October, there'll be some day when all of these amazing new best practices, because the crisis is quote unquote over, they're gonna get like collectively sucked back into their foundations, into boardrooms, into grants management software programs, right? And locked down, never to be seen again. And there'll be this large, loud whooshing sound that goes around the world as all of these great practices are retracted. And so I guess my goal is also to prevent that large whooshing sound from happening. I do want to share a little housekeeping. Obviously, you figured out that you're not on video and you're muted. There is opportunity to ask questions. Some of you emailed me questions in advance, and I'm going to go through them in a little bit. I have a lot of content to cover, so in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is get through a lot of the content, and then I'm going to pause for questions that you're sharing, and you can use the Q&A function on this Zoom webinar, which either is at the top of your screen or the bottom, depending on how it's working on your device, to ask questions. My associate, Lori, is also on this call, but not on video, and she's working behind the scenes, so she'll be scanning that list of questions for me, and if there's anything clarifying, if I'm confusing or you didn't understand something, she's going to hopefully pop on and interrupt me and ask me to explain a little bit better what I'm talking about. And I think that's it. If, you know, technology falls apart and the internet drops or whatever it is, I'm going to try my best to get back on. I'll ask you to give me a few minutes to figure that out. Hopefully we'll be fine and good to go. Of course, the agenda I do want to cover is I want to talk a little bit about feeling fearful and overwhelmed and how that can hold us back. I am, of course, going to share 7 ways that you can increase your impact during this crisis, pause for questions, and then talk about some specific action steps that you can take immediately. So when we first all went into lockdown mode, I called 2 foundation CEOs that I know. I just wanted to check on them and see how they were doing and how I could help. So I called one, and I got the voicemail, which I expected, and the voicemail said something like, "We're all working from home. Please leave a message in our general mailbox." Beep. So this foundation had actually dismantled their voicemail system. So you no longer could even attempt to leave a message for your program officer or the CEO or anybody, right? They actually made it harder for their grantees to apply for funding. I then called another foundation CEO, and unsurprisingly, I got her voicemail, but her voicemail said something like, "We're all working from home. However, we are all checking our voicemail multiple times a day. I will get back to you quickly. And here's my cell phone. You are welcome to call me anytime." And so I did. And she answered the phone, to my surprise. And then she went on to describe to me how within days their foundation had offered additional funding to their grantees, required no application, just told the nonprofits to come pick up the check. They had offered a webinar on business continuity for nonprofit organizations. They unrestricted their grants and literally told their grantees, "We completely trust you. Spend this however you think is necessary, and we'll get back to you at some future date. And if we can help you in the meantime, let us know. Don't worry about any deadlines," right? So when you think about it, if you're a nonprofit organization, who do you want as your funder? The one who, during a crisis, has made it harder for you to reach them, or who during a crisis has not only made it easier for you to reach them, but they're actively communicating and adapting and innovating and leading the way. So let's talk a little bit about feeling fearful and overwhelmed. I'm guessing the chances are pretty good that sometime in the past day, week, or month, you have felt either of those things or both at the same time. It's been a scary time for a lot of us. I'll just share a personal story. My husband has a business, and all of his customers are restaurants. And so in Ohio, where we live, the day that our governor declared that all restaurants were to close on a Sunday, on Monday, he learned that he had lost 85% of his customers. And on Tuesday, he had to lay off 85% of his employees. So it was a very scary and fearful and overwhelming time. And we're all experiencing some version of that story. It could be a loved one who's ill and can't get the care they need right now, whatever it might be. But I want to share this with you because, you know, when I wrote the book, Delusional Altruism, which I just published recently, last month, I wrote the book because I recognized that after 20 years of advising philanthropists, for the most part, I felt that they're genuinely trying to make a difference, really wanted to change the world in meaningful, important ways, but often were getting in their own way. And they were preventing themselves from having the impact that they sought, and often didn't even realize this. And I think, you know, this is where the delusional altruism comes from. It's really that there's these illogical thoughts that are holding us back and preventing us from creating change. And two of these delusions are feeling fearful and overwhelmed. In fact, I think these are such big problems that I actually wrote a chapter in the book on each of them. And I want to share with you a couple points about this. The first is that philanthropists feel fearful and overwhelmed even in the best of times. It might be fearing loss of control about how grants are spent, so we tightly restrict them. It might be fear of failing, so we don't take risks. We might feel overwhelmed because we have organized our schedules with back-to-back-to-back-to-back meetings, and we never ever have time to reflect or think or plan or follow up on any of the things that we just said for ourselves. Or we feel overwhelmed because we don't have a clear strategy of what we're trying to do, much less a plan for how to actually get there. So feeling fearful and overwhelmed is actually normal. In philanthropy, and it's a problem. It causes a lot of problems, and this is the second point I want to make, because it causes us to waste time, waste energy, waste our resources, waste our talent. We can't be as effective as we should be able to be. It prevents us from learning, it prevents us from improving, and it prevents us from having the impact that we want. And it's a problem that we really need to address in the best of times, much less during the worst global crisis in a century. And the third point I want to make is that we actually have more power to and control over feeling fearful and feeling overwhelmed than we might realize. And it's important, especially now when things, a lot of things feel out of control, to try to take back some of that control. So it's things like simply, you know, not watching the news all day long and really restricting or limiting how often and when you turn the news on, right? Or it could be making sure that you're taking care of yourself and getting exercise and getting enough sleep and eating well so that you are your best self and can handle what's happening around you. It can also be, you know, retaining advisors and coaches who can help us. And we certainly have the power to do that. So for example, going back to my husband's example, he had been working with a business coach for the past, I don't know, 6 to 9 months, helping him put a lot of systems in place and really positioning himself for the exit that was supposed to be part of our retirement, which who knows when that's going to happen now. But nonetheless, so he was actually well positioned from a business perspective. So in all of this, when his, you know, business was sort of disintegrating in front of his eyes, he was able to call a trusted advisor and coach who could help him, like talk him through step by step what to do. Like literally tomorrow, here's what you do. And then the next day, here's what you do. We can also invest in systems and technology on a regular basis that can help us. So for example, another of my clients had not done that, right? And so they're one of many funders. Many of you, I'm sure, are in this situation where the only way you can make grants is physically signing a check, and those are in the office, and you can't get there because you're on lockdown, right? So that caused a lot of overwhelm for her staff because they wanted to be quick and get the money out the door quickly, but they couldn't. And then the last, of course, is, you know, you can implement these seven steps that I'm going to share with you today. Okay, so in my experience, there are six different ways that philanthropists respond to a crisis, and not just this one, but any crisis. And I'm going to just briefly go over these from bottom to top. So the first is they hide. They go into hiding, they're under the covers, they're in the fetal position, they are so overwhelmed or fearful or something that they simply can't respond. And this is happening. These are the ones that are not in the news because we don't know where they are. Right, there's a lot of billionaires who are giving away a lot of money right now to help respond to this crisis, which is fabulous. And there are a lot of billionaires that are nowhere to be seen. The second response is the wait and see approach. And these are the people who are, their intention is really, we're gonna wait and see how this whole thing shakes out before we figure out what to do. So I was talking to a colleague who's a CEO of a foundation, and he said his board was about to embark on strategic planning before this COVID crisis happened. And so they've halted everything. And they've said they're going to wait and see how they as a foundation should respond. And the next time they're going to get together is at their previously scheduled board retreat in September, which is, what, 7 months from now, 6 months from now. So that's their plan. They want to wait and see. The next are the folks who give. Who gave right away. So this, of course, is probably everyone on this call has responded in this way for sure. You've made grants, you've either given additional funding to your existing grantees, you've funded other organizations, maybe safety net organizations or national responders, you've contributed to your local crisis response fund, which is all fabulous. Like, that's really a great way to respond. Next is adapt. And this is, I think, you know, we're really hearing a lot of these stories now of funders that are, and I'm also believe this is many of you, who have made changes to how you give. So you've removed deadlines. You have told grantees they can spend the money however they want to. You've eliminated or dramatically reduced your applications. You've, you know, provided a lot of additional support to nonprofits in different ways than you had done before. So you're adapting how you give. The next is create. So also there are a lot of funders that are creating new ways of giving. They're the ones who are creating the crisis response funds in their communities. A lot of community foundations are at the center of that. Or they're creating new partnerships, new collaborations that didn't exist, you know, last week, much less last year, to respond. Or they're creating new webinars, new technology, new trainings for their nonprofit partners to help them apply for the federal loans, for example. And then the last group is transform, the foundations that are transforming how they give for greater impact. And so you might want to know what that means. So let me tell you. So I believe that there are seven ways that foundations can transform how they give in order to have a more transformational impact on the issues and causes they care about. And I'm going to go over all of these in greater detail, but just to review them briefly now, it includes increasing your agility, being more adaptive, innovating as a funder, increasing your speed, clarifying or setting your strategy and then implementing it. And the last is sealing watertight doors, which I will explain in a little bit. So this is a graphic visual to share with you why I think this is important, these steps to be transformational. So if you look at this graphic from left to right, you see at the left, you know, we were in this quote unquote normal phase, right? Things were humming along. And then suddenly we hit a crisis, and that crisis could be a global pandemic. It could be AIDS. It could be a recession. It could be floods or a hurricane. It could be all kinds of things, right? And we are initially in shock when that happens. We're in shock when that happens. And again, we react in a variety of ways. We hide, we wait, we give, adapt, create, or we transform as a result. And then we move into what I call an acceptance phase, which is, you know, really, I think where we, a lot of us are right now, depending on when this crisis is hitting your community, we are no longer in a complete state of panic. We've gotten used to working from home. We've gotten used to homeschooling our children as much as we might not like it. We're kind of used to it by now. We've stocked up on toilet paper and frozen chicken. You know, we've gotten our all of our supplies in order. We've made our initial round of grants. And we're really in a stage where we're somewhat inured. We almost like a callus, if you will, has built up. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a, we're not as sensitive to the immediate crisis as we were last month, for example. And then we're going to move into a recovery stage. Recovery is always inevitable. This crisis is not going to last forever. We don't know exactly how long that will be or how long it will take, but recovery is inevitable. And then we will enter a phase of impact. And I believe the funders who are able to truly transform how they give in meaningful ways and lasting ways are the ones that are going to move the fastest through this, that are going to lead the way and have the greatest impact. So let's talk about each of these one by one. And I want to really kind of unpack these a bit because I think these are all terms, agility, adaptive, innovative, that we throw around and we know the meaning of more or less, but it's hard to know really what to do with that or how to be more of it, right? And so agility is really that you as a funder are seeing and capitalizing on new opportunities quickly, that you're kind of always looking for new sources of innovation and you can act quickly on them and remain flexible in all the work that you're doing. It's really a proactive approach where you're constantly searching for new opportunities as well as threats and figuring out, you know, how you could take advantage of them or how you can navigate around them. And I think there's also a helpful way to think about breaking up agility into three parts. And I'm borrowing this concept from a friend of mine, Amanda Satilli, who wrote a book about agility. And she describes market agility, decision agility, and execution agility. And market agility, you can also think about, you know, that's more of a business concept, but you could think about the marketplace, the environment in which we are working. It's really identifying potential opportunities proactively that are being created by changes in the environment or changes in the marketplace. It could be the election of a new president. It could be policy changes that are happening or changes in demographics. What are those changes happening, those threats or positive changes? And how can we identify possible opportunities based upon them? Decision agility really means that you're capitalizing on those opportunities. You're able to identify possible alternatives, you can capitalize them on them, and you can make decisions quickly. What's interesting is I don't think many of us think about how do we make decisions, like as a person or as an organization, whose decision is it? What informs a decision and how quickly can we make them? And so I think, you know, that's really important. And it's an area where philanthropy often is slow. You know, it's hard to be agile when making a decision means you have to embark on a 6-month learning tour, right, to learn something, or you have to conduct strategic planning for a year before you can decide on a strategy. And then the execution agility is being able to quickly move on those decisions once you've made them. You can act on them quickly. I like to think of the 80-20 rule here, which is, in this case, when you're 80% there, you move. So you've got it figured out 80%, start moving on it, start acting on it, start executing it, because you can have the confidence that you'll figure out the remaining 20% along the way. So how do we increase our agility? I think we can start by asking ourselves questions such as these. So are we continually scanning our environment? Are we on the lookout at all times for opportunities? Are we noticing changes that are happening? Are we regularly exposed to new ideas and new ways of thinking? And I think especially outside the field of philanthropy, you know, as a consultant, I work in philanthropy, but I'm part of a global network of consultants who I learn from all the time, and none of them work in philanthropy. They work in different aspects of business and other sectors. But I like that because it's giving me constant sources of fresh ideas and new ways of thinking that I can then apply to my work and to my clients. Do we have criteria for making decisions? Are we able to execute quickly? Why or why not? Are we routinely reviewing and investing in our talent and technology? You know, philanthropy is comprised of people, right? We are all people doing this work. So are we thinking regularly about, do we have people who are agile and who can respond and execute and make decisions quickly? Do we have the technology to enable us to do that? And then lastly, what's slowing us down? And those questions, I think, can be very helpful in helping you to increase your agility. The second area is being adaptive and increasing the extent to which you can be adaptive. And again, this is a term that I think is often confused with, whoops. Uh-oh. Good. There we go. Often confused with agility. But whereas agility is proactive, you're actively doing this all the time, actively searching for new opportunities, being adaptive is reactive. You're responding. So it's when change happens to you or around you or inside your organization even, you have the ability consistently to be able to accommodate yourself and adapt and maximize the benefit of change. When change happens, you can change yourself and your approach. And certainly, you know, we are all being adaptive right this very second, right? We all, like, no one expected to be working from home except those of us who were previously working from home. Suddenly, here we are. We're all watching this or participating via our laptops at home, our computers. We've managed to figure out how to work from home and interact with our colleagues in new ways when change like this virus happened to us. So in 2016, I was working with the Community Foundation of, or 2017, when I was working with the Community Foundation of Sonoma County when wildfires broke out. And the project we had been working on was to help them revamp their business model because they felt their business model was outdated and they wanted to revise it to adapt to the times. But then the fires broke out and they went on for days or weeks. 36,000 acres were destroyed, 5,300 homes burned to the ground, including entire neighborhoods completely wiped out. There was $13 billion in damage. And of course, the result of all of that was tremendous negative impact on the economy, on people's lives, and certainly on people's mental health. But this foundation, the Community Foundation of Sonoma County, adapted immediately to its new situation, this new change, even while the fires were literally still burning around them. They changed how they gave. They created new partnerships and new collaboratives within a week to be able to respond to new community needs. They recognized that while the fire didn't discriminate because homes of all sizes and types and buildings burnt down, the recovery certainly did discriminate. And the people who were less well off before the fire had the hardest time recovering. So less financial security, less food security, poor housing, less access to healthcare and mental health benefits and things like that. So they adapted a equity lens in all of their grant making as a result of that. And then the third is, as they were originally thinking about their business model, one of the things they were intending to do was as a community foundation to become more of a community leader, rather than just a community bank or a community grant maker. And so literally within days or hours of this fire breaking out, they stepped into that community leadership role that they hadn't even finished figuring out, right? Because that's what they had to do and that's what they wanted to do. So they were easily able to adapt and change their work. And I think, you know, this is also examples of things that we're seeing now and how foundations are responding. The Moses Taylor Foundation in Scranton, Pennsylvania, you know, told all of its grantees, we completely trust you, spend your current grant however you see fit. And, you know, at some point in the future, we'll give you a call. You don't need to submit a report. We'll just take some notes and see how you did. The Robert Sterling Clark Foundation in New York gave an extra year of funding to all of their grantees without them even having to ask for it. Many funders that are removing restrictions and forging new partnerships. And I think the important question really is, can we, as we know we can adapt, right? We're doing it, but can we do this consistently? And can we continue to be adaptive even when we're not in a crisis? So again, what are some things that you can do to be like this chameleon or whatever kind of lizard this is that is adapting to its environment and changing its color? Here are some questions that I think you could start asking yourselves. The first is, what does being adaptive mean to us in the context of our philanthropy? How have we adapted so far, right? How did we adapt to this crisis? And what was it like? Was it easy? Was it difficult? Why was that, right? What's the advantage to us in being able to be adaptive, to being able to consistently change our approach in response to changes that are around us? You know, what's the value of that to ourselves, to our grantees, to our community? And then what steps can we take now to be more adaptive? All right, so I next want to talk about being more innovative. And I define innovation as applied creativity. So being creative is great, but applying it in meaningful ways is innovative. And this is an example of this image here of innovation in face masks, right? So we all have experienced face masks or learned about face masks, discovered we can't find any face masks. But there's been innovations, including from this college senior who recognized that people who are deaf or hard of hearing were at a disadvantage when everyone's wearing a mask because they couldn't read lips. They could, and we all can't see facial expressions, right? And that's an important part of communicating, especially in a healthcare situation, to be able to smile at someone that's actually quite meaningful. But what's interesting to me about innovation is how often the term is used and how infrequently we really know what we're talking about. So my first job in philanthropy, I was told that the foundation funded innovative projects. And I said, great, what do we mean by innovation? And no one could give me an answer because it hadn't really been thought about before and we hadn't actually defined it. And I think in philanthropy, we often expect the onus of innovation to be on the grantees. We want to fund innovative leaders, we want to fund innovative projects, but we don't define what we mean. And we really don't often talk about how do you develop innovative capacity. I mean, you think about all the capacity building trainings and things we've learned about as a field, I rarely hear about building capacity to be innovative. But what I really want you to walk away with today is the belief that you, yes, you, can be innovative, that we as funders, that everybody can be innovative and generate innovative ideas. And doing that doesn't necessarily mean you create the cure to the coronavirus. It doesn't mean that you create the iPhone of early childhood education, right? Innovation can happen in small but really meaningful ways, and it can be a part, generating innovative ideas can really be a part of our everyday. It's something we can do on a regular basis. That's interesting. I'm just learning that my battery is running low. Okay, so I am going to do something. I'm going to pause this for a second, if I can figure out how to do that. All right, I'm going to pause the webinar for a second, and I'm going to switch locations so that I can plug my computer in. So just stay right there. Don't go where you are. I'm going to stop sharing my computer. I'm going to turn off my video and my audio.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to ask Lori, my assistant, to tell me if you can hear me and see the screens.
You are all set. You are back.
Excellent.
All right.
It's so funny. You know, you can never prepare for everything, right? So literally before this started, I was checking my battery power and I had like 75% battery. I don't know how that happened. But nonetheless, here we are. So good. So the point I wanted to make was that as funders, you can generate innovative ideas as a regular course of doing business. So I want to talk about that. Oops. There we go. Okay. So we often think that innovation is the same as problem solving, and I want to talk a little bit about innovation and problem solving. So here on the screen, you see that, you know, you're going along from left to right, you have standard performance, everything is going smoothly, and then there's a decline, there's a problem, there's a crisis, and things decline, things go down. Then you fix the problem, and then you're back to where you were before. You've restored your standard performance. Back to the status quo. But innovation is different, right? Innovation means there you are, everything's fine. Then suddenly there's a problem. Things go wrong. Your technology stops working. Your battery runs out. But instead of fixing the problem, you create a new innovative solution to the problem. And you actually improve your performance back from what it was before. And I think this is really an area where we need to be thinking about, not just when there's a problem, this is something we can be doing all the time, right? Things can be going along just fine. And you think, wow, this could be even better. Let's generate an innovative approach and solution to this. So how do you innovate? Again, I think it's really important to talk about how we actually do this. And so I think there's four conditions that really need to be in place, four foundations to become innovative. And the first is that there needs to be the leaders in your organization, whether that's the donor, the CEO, whoever it is, or your family, the parents. The leaders genuinely believe and champion the importance of being innovative. There also needs to be a belief that everybody in your operation, and I mean everybody, has the ability to generate innovative ideas. And I mean like from the janitor, the receptionist, the intern, your 15-year-old grandson, to the billionaire, and everyone in between, that this can be quickly adapted and generated. The third is that you're willing to regularly come up with innovative ideas and try them out. And the last is that you recognize that not every innovative idea is worth pursuing, and you actually look at the risks and make sure you only take prudent risks, essentially. So what do you do? How do you do this? You really want to, as an organization, and again, you can do this in your staff meetings, you can do it in your family around the kitchen table, you want to search for sources of innovative ideas. And by this I mean, look for where are there unexpected successes, like maybe you've been focusing on policy advocacy and you were stunned that the legislation passed so quickly. Unexpected success, unexpected failure. You've been funding efforts to improve graduation rates and they're declining instead of increasing. Unexpected change in events like a pandemic or maybe a change in demographics or whatever it might be. But really search for changes that are happening and ask yourself questions like what kinds of external or internal events have occurred or changes have happened. And with those ideas, you can really ask yourself, you know, what kinds of opportunities does this provide us? What kind of ideas can we develop from these challenges or opportunities? Are there new services or products or approaches that we can create that would take advantage of the situation or to meet a need. So you can regularly ask yourself these questions and literally generate innovative ideas, and then take those ideas and assess them. Look at them against cost, benefit, strategic fit, or how easy it is to implement. You can then, begin to, you kick the tires. If it's worth pursuing, you can begin to develop those innovations. And again, if they continue to meet your criteria and you think they're worth pursuing and you've assessed the risk, then you can begin implementing them. And it really, I'm talking a matter of weeks, maybe months. I'm not talking years. Okay, let's talk about speed and the importance of increasing your speed. I want to share a few ideas. Generally speaking, I think philanthropy moves slowly. Although there's certainly been examples of funders speeding things up lately. But I think this is such a problem. Again, in my book, Delusional Altruism, I wrote two chapters on this. One about how philanthropy moves too slowly and one on how to increase our speed. So here's a few ideas I just want to share with you. The first is to think like a mechanic, like this woman right here. Mechanics will look under the hood to identify problems. They'll check fluids because they know that that's important for maintaining the operation of the car. They will regularly maintain and fix small things because they know that regular maintenance will keep the car humming along for longer periods of time, right? And I think as funders, we really need to look under our own hoods, look under the hoods of our philanthropy and identify where are there blockages, where is there duplication, and where is there waste. So that we can remove them and speed things up. I was talking to another foundation CEO who was starting work at her job, joining the foundation, existing foundation, and she was stunned to learn that it took this foundation an average of 9 months to make a grant. And, clearly because all this blockage had been allowed to be created and stick there, that these processes kind of kept building upon themselves. She also learned, interestingly, that although the foundation had not spent any effort to change the policies in order to streamline their grant making, they did have a policy for how the kitchen should be cleaned in their foundation office, a written kitchen cleaning policy. But this is super easy to do, super easy to look under your hood, because it's all the things that frustrate you and your team, right? So you can ask yourselves, like, where are their blockages? Where is their duplication? Let's come up with some ideas for how we can remove them so we can speed ourselves up. I'm sure you've bumped into a lot of them in the past month when you've had to work very differently. The second is to commit to the 50% principle. And this is simply looking at anything or everything that you're doing and ask yourself, how can we do this in half the time? And then try to do that, right? So if it's your staff meeting that lasts 2.5, 3 hours, can you do it in an hour? If it's a phone call that you assume should take an hour, can you do it in 30 minutes? If it's your strategic planning process that you assume will take 6 months, can you do it in 3? And just like literally pull out your calendar and look at all the stuff you have and just act like it can all be done in half the time, and then try to do that, or pick a few things and try to do them more quickly. Now, this doesn't mean that in your 2-hour staff meeting, you just cut everybody off at the first hour and leave, right? You probably have to prepare and do your work differently. Think about your agenda differently. Think about preparation, what information can be shared in advance, but I bet you can shave off a lot of time that frees yourself up for more important work that you need to be doing. And the third is to think like a 2-year-old. In my book, I talk about 12 questions that foundations should be asking themselves. And the very first one is why. And as we all know, 2-year-olds often will ask why about everything. But I think we really need to ask ourselves why more often, because, there are no shortage of problems in the world, and there's really no shortage of shiny sounding solutions and ideas, right? And we often hear them when we come back from conferences or virtual conferences. And we often jump into these ideas without really thinking about why we're doing it and if it's really the right fit for us. So things like crowdfunding or emotional intelligence, or even diversifying your board of directors, right? These are all important things. They're all good ideas, but you need to ask yourself why, even the diversifying your board, it's probably a good idea, but why now? Is that really the right thing we need to do now? Or are there other things that we as a board need to do to understand, for example, our own racism or our own implicit bias, or how this family got its money and its wealth over the past century, and what implications are that are in there for its negative impact on the community? So maybe that's what we need to do first before we jump to diversifying our board, for example. So just asking why, so that you can make sure that what you're doing is the most important thing that you should be focusing on. Okay, the next two are about clarifying your strategy and implementing your strategy. And then after that, I'm going to pause for questions, and then we'll wrap up with some action steps that you can take. So briefly, strategy I define as a framework within which decisions are made that impact the nature and the direction of your enterprise. And your enterprise is you, your foundation, your donor advised fund, your corporate giving program, your family, whatever it is, you and your spouse, right? And strategy really has two parts, formulation and implementation, and both are really important. And the value, I think, of strategy is that you have clear tools to help you decide and make choices that are congruent with the direction you want your philanthropy to go in and what you want to accomplish. It really helps you identify who you want to be, let's say a year from now, what kind of change you want to create, and how do you get from where you are today to where you want to be, ideally as quickly as possible. And I really believe that, you know, strategy should happen year to year. You know, your mission remains the same. It's why you exist. But your strategy can be refreshed on an annual basis. And I think now, really more than ever, this pandemic is showing us the futility in spending a year to create a strategic plan for the next 3 years, right? Because we can't possibly know what the next 3 years holds. And really, I think even if you have a strategy right now, now is the time to take a look at it and refresh it. Because we're living in a different world than we lived in, chances are, when your strategy was developed, even if that was 5 months ago. And some things need to change, and some things stay the same, and some things probably need to be radically overhauled or eliminated, right? And if you don't have one, now is actually the time to create it. You can do strategy development quickly and remotely, so that instead of looking like these people who are sitting in this photo less than 6 inches from each other, you look like these people. And you really can facilitate strategic planning on Zoom or GoToMeeting or any of these platforms. You can put people in small groups. You can do all sorts of things. You just need to kind of organize your time a little bit differently. And then also, we can't just have a strategy. We need to actually implement it. I think there's a few key things for strategy implementation. And the first is to get clear on what your top priorities are, your top priorities for implementing your strategy. What needs to happen next? What are the 3 to 5 things that need to happen next? And ideally, you figure that out at the end of your strategy retreat or the last session of your Zoom facilitated strategy discussion, right? So everyone walks away knowing what the most important things are across your organization to do next, and you assign people to be accountable to each of them. And you give them a deadline. So, you know, in the next, you know, Bob, you're responsible for priority number one. Come back in 2 weeks at our staff meeting and give us a progress update on what you think are the next things that need to happen and the team you're putting together and, you know, what progress you've made. So you get things happening quickly. You keep that momentum going. You really need to, in strategy implementation, also think about what's going to need to change. Depending on how big a shift your new strategy is from what you were doing before, you likely need to change some aspects of your people, your systems, your processes, whatever it is that you're working on, your operations, to align to the new strategy. You know, what got you here won't necessarily get you there. And you need to think about changes. And then maintaining momentum, keeping everyone appraised of what's going on, the progress that's being made, like regularly, every 2 weeks, so people can really see what's happening. You want to think about this as a series of short sprints and not a marathon, with milestones along the way, and people can see progress. Before I move to questions, I just want to say one thing, share one thing. During this time, I'm really trying to help as many philanthropists as I can because I believe the work that you're doing is too important, and I want to be as helpful as possible. So one of the things that I'm offering is a free 45-minute phone or Zoom or Skype or whatever technology you want to use consultation with me to discuss your strategy. And together we can look at it, see if it might need to be refreshed, see what needs to change, what needs to stay the same, or if you don't have one, how you could quickly create one. So if that is of interest to you, just email me. My email is chris@putnam-consulting.com. And let me know, and we can get a call scheduled at your convenience. And hopefully I can be helpful to you in that way. All right, so I'm going to move to questions. And in the limited time we have, I'm just going to start with a few of the questions that I received via email. The first is a very practical one. How can I stay focused while working from home with children? And this is one that is near and dear to my heart because I have 10-year-old twins, and I hear you. I've been working from home for 20 years, and it's never been this difficult because in addition to the full-time job, you're now a full-time childcare provider, and you're navigating homeschooling, which is really challenging. So I would say a couple things. One is going back to the priorities I was just talking about. Ideally, whoever you are, if you work in an organization, your organization knows what its top priorities are, like right now, like the next couple months, right, through summer. And then you know what you need to focus on to help align to those priorities, right? Related to that, I think also figuring out what are your priorities on a day-to-day basis. So quite frankly, when you get up in the morning, you know, thinking about what are the one, two, or three things that you can get done that day, again, that align toward the big picture priorities, but give yourself some slack. You know, it might be that you get one thing done because your kid has a meltdown and you can't get as much done as you wanted to accomplish. You need to give yourself a break. I think the other thing that I've learned before this crisis, and it's even more real now, is you can't multitask parenting and working because you'll fail at both, or you'll just be not very good at both. The other day I was trying to make my son a grilled cheese sandwich for lunch, and I thought, oh, I'll just check my email while I am doing this. And I basically burned 3 grilled cheese sandwiches, one after the other, because I kept burning them because I kept getting distracted by my email. And finally, the last one, I had run out of cheese. And I just turned it over, like I turned the burn part over and handed it to him because I was done, right? So you have to separate to the best that you can working from home and working and being with your kids.
Chris, it's Lori.
Yeah.
It looks like you stopped with number 6, implement your strategy, and we didn't get to number 7, and we've had a couple people ask if we could see what number 7 is.
Yes, because number 7 is going to come after the questions.
Okay, sorry. Just making sure. Just making sure.
Thank you.
All right.
Yes. So let me, I think I covered some of the questions that have already been shared. I'm just going to look at the Q&A here quickly and see if I can get to some of these. So Tanir, hi Tanir. We'd like to continue giving unrestricted multi-year grants to community partners, and we want to make the application process and reporting as easy and streamlined as possible. So if we still want some kind of streamlined application, what do you think are key questions to ask that work well for both sides? So that's a great question. I would look at the question is, you know, how do we make this easy? I would look at your current grant making questions and ask yourself, like, literally, what are these questions have we actually found to be useful in the past, right? And eliminate any that were sort of interesting to you but didn't actually help you make funding decisions. And then I would get really clear right now for this next phase of time, sort of in this crisis and immediate recovery, as to what you actually need to know from the grantee. And also, what's the best way to collect that information? Because you don't have to get that information through an application process, right? You can actually get it by picking up the phone and calling your grantee and asking them for the information, or you gathering it yourself as a foundation. There are a lot of funders, and I give a few examples in the book, that that have taken it upon themselves to gather the information that they need. So I would look at those two things. And you know what, I think in the interest of time, I just have 5 minutes, and there's a few more points I want to make. So what I'm gonna do is, I see there's a number of other questions. I'm going to respond to them all in writing, and I will share them all with you when I share the, I'm gonna share this recording with all of you in the next day. And I will share my responses to your questions, because I see a lot of really interesting questions here, including, can we get a copy of the presentation? It is excellent. Thank you, person that said that. I appreciate it. Yes, I'm going to share this, and it's available to anybody. So if you're finding this helpful, feel free to share it widely with colleagues, and feel free to reach out to me with additional questions. So that said, I am going to hopefully... Aha. Move to the seventh point that this person was anxiously waiting for. And this is the concept of watertight doors that I'd like to share with you. So to your left, if you look at the visual from, again, left to right, there was your philanthropy before the crisis started, like 2 months ago or last year, whatever it was. The way you gave money away. And then since that happened, kind of going up this arrow, of transforming, you probably have been changing some things of how you're giving. And I'm just giving these as examples. You might have removed restrictions. You might have gotten grants out the door more quickly. You did clarify your strategy. You got everyone on board. You began executing it. You developed innovative partnerships, whatever you did, right? Well, those are all like your new best practices. And what I think that you should do is think about sealing the watertight doors behind you, slamming them shut, locking the door, tossing the key, so that you force yourself to continue doing them going forward. Because it's likely if you don't do that, you're gonna slide back into your old ways. You know, if you think about the water underneath you, there's a current moving in the opposite direction that you wanna go. And it's full of things like inertia and forgetfulness and your old ways, your old habits, a scarcity mindset. And those are all going to take hold of you, much like if you're swimming in the ocean, a current will take hold of you. But if you really think about sealing those watertight doors and preventing yourself from going back, then you can really think about how do we continue to transform the way we give going forward. And I think there's some questions here that will be helpful for you to figure out what that means specifically, so that you can reflect and learn and act on what you're doing right now or what you will start to do soon, which is simply, as your team, ask yourselves, you know, what did we do differently as a result of this crisis or to respond to this crisis? And what was the result of that? What did we put in place before the crisis? Maybe what did we accidentally put into place before the crisis? Who knew it would be so helpful right now? One of my clients started online payments like in January because they felt like they should be doing that. And they were so grateful that was in place during the crisis. What do we wish we had done before? Or if we could do it all over again, I mean, God forbid we have another pandemic, but it's certainly possible, or any other crisis. If we could do this all over again, what would we do differently? Is always a really good question to ask. What new things did we try that didn't work out so well? We can learn from those experiences as well. What are our new best practices that we want to maintain going forward? It doesn't have to be everything, but it should be some things. And then how can they be applied elsewhere in our organization? So let's say, you know, you were all great at learning Zoom and learning new technology. That's fabulous. So how can you apply that elsewhere in your organization so that you're constantly upgrading your technology and upgrading your learning? Upgrading your professional development in all aspects of your operation. I want to also remind you that my book, Delusional Altruism, is available. If you would be interested in purchasing copies, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if you want bulk discounts, it's even available at porchlight.com. But I share this with you because, again, a lot of the ideas I shared in this presentation come from the book, and there's a lot of other ideas and suggestions and ways that you can understand some of the things that are holding you back as funders, the ways that we all get in our own way, usually unintentionally and inadvertently, and additional suggestions and ideas and solutions for how you can transform how you give in order to have a more transformational impact on the issues and communities that you truly care about. Again, you can contact me. You don't need to use the tin can method. You are welcome to email me or call me, my website. Again, if I could be helpful to you to discuss really any of these ideas we've shared, to more fully answer your questions, or if you'd like help with your strategy work, I'm happy just to talk with you for free for 45 minutes and help you in any way that I can. So I look forward to further conversations, and I will be sharing this with you in the next day. I'll also be posting it on my website for those of you that are watching this later and would also like to share it. Thank you very much, and I look forward to being in contact with you.